Sehariah and Tovim to all. And something interesting happened on my way from LaGuardia to my hotel. I did something I'd never done before. From my app on my iPhone, I checked into my hotel, got my key on my iPhone, and went right to my room. And it occurred to me that 30 years ago, that would not have been possible. Because 30 years ago, we didn't even have fax machines. Could you imagine Shimon Gruber with a web page on Facebook? Hard to imagine. So, yeah, that sort of dates the crowd. But part of the reality of this wonderful institution for decades, Zichrono Livracha. Now, speaking of change, because a lot has happened in 30 years, and some of it's unsettling in the outside world, it's intimidating, but in the case of our assembly and our movement, exciting and exhilarating. So the topic for this afternoon's session is the ordination of women as a model for the process of halachic change in the conservative movement. And we have two outstanding halachists and two outstanding members of our assembly who are going to be addressing this topic. Rabbi Pamela Barmash, those of us who were fortunate enough to participate in the RA Shabbaton in March in Washington, had the privilege of studying with Pamela. And Pamela has degrees from this institution and from Yale and Harvard, and is professor of Hebrew Bible at Washington University, and as we Canadians say, Saint Louis, and as you Americans say, Saint Louis.
Rangers say it also.
And was a fellow at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. Has served with great distinction on the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, and has been one who's taken our Torah and spread it throughout the very, very diverse communities on the continent and elsewhere. And we're very, very grateful to have the opportunity to learn from Pamela this afternoon. Rabbi Gordon Tucker just honored this past Sunday evening by the Masorti Foundation at an event many of us were privileged to attend for his wonderful work on behalf of the Foundation for Conservative Judaism in Israel, the Masorti Foundation. Also served for, I believe, two decades on the ECJLS with incredible distinction, and serves as a senior rabbi of Temple Israel Center in White Plains, New York. And a source of great pride to me is his involvement in creating one of the two commentaries on the forthcoming RA edition of Pirkei Avot, and one commentary by Gordon Tucker and the other by Tamar Elad Applebaum. And this will be an amazing contribution to Jewish liturgy and to Jewish learning, hopefully on its way this fall. And you'll hear more about it. And as many of you know, most of you know, Gordon served as dean of the rabbinical school at this institution and involved in so many aspects of community as well. And again, a teacher to many, rabbi, friend, and we're delighted to start with Gordon, who will be followed by Pamela.
Thank you very much, Phil. I thought that Shimon Gruber started Amazon. Does this stay here? So, first I want to say something about the commission. Including myself, there were 14 members, and sadly, only five of us are still alive today. You've seen two of them here, Francine Clagsburn yesterday, a New York author, and myself. The others include two now retired rabbis, Wilfred Shushat of Montreal and Eli Shochet of Canoga Park, California, as well as Rivka Harris, then a professor of Assyriology at the University of Chicago. I think we owe it to all of the members, living and dead, to remember who they were, so here are the names of the departed members of the commission. Chaim Zalman Dimitrovsky, revered professor of Talmud here at JTS. Victor Goodhill, an ENT surgeon and professor of otolaryngology. Marion Siner Gordon, a lawyer and a former president of Women's League. Milton Himmelfarb of the American Jewish Committee wrote extensively on the sociology of the American Jewish community. Fishel Perlmutter, rabbi of Temple B'nai Israel in Toledo, Ohio. Harry Plotkin, the founding partner of a prominent Washington law firm, Norman Redlich, Dean of the NYU Law School. Seymour Siegel, Professor of Talmud and Ethics at JTS. And of course, its chairman, Chancellor Gerson David Cohen. May the memories of these nine be a blessing. And although the diversity of fields was disturbing to some purists, as was the idea even of faculty members not of the Talmud and Halakha department eventually voting on JTS policy on the matter, this was no diminution of the central role of halakhic literature. On the contrary, it was a starting axiom of the commission, and you heard a little funny quip about that from Francine yesterday. The starting axiom was that it would not recommend a contravention of anything that it conscientiously saw to be compelled by the halakhic literature. But many different eyes were going to be put to work on understanding that literature, and people were going to teach and learn from one another. And the commission was, I believe, true to that axiom. I want to quote for you a pasuk from Kohelet, chapter 5, verse 11. Mituka shenata oved im ma'at v'im harbe yochel, v'hasava le'ashir einenu maniach lo lishon. A laborer's sleep is sweet, whether he has little or much to eat, but the rich man's abundance doesn't let him sleep. I want to recall for you what the Midrash Tanchuma has to say about that last phrase. It says, imagine a person who is fabulously wealthy in Torah. He taught many students, he lectured on the Torah publicly, he was completely suffused with Torah. Even though he may now be dead, the students whom he nurtured will not let him sleep. Rather, his students sit and busy themselves with the Torah, Talmud, Halakha, and Agadah that he taught. And moreover, the disciples cite his teachings and mention his name all the time, and thus give him no slumber in his grave. In other words, the rich man's abundance doesn't let him sleep. What a blessing that is. So I begin with this because I'm going to address today's topic through the lens of such a rich man. My mentor and teacher, my spiritual guide. I'm grateful, very grateful to Bill Gershon and to Francine Klagsborn for reminding us all what a central and heroic role he played in this, Rabbi Gerson D. Cohen. So let me show my hand at the outset, and I hope this doesn't sound too contrarian given the title of this session. There are so many good and solid reasons to celebrate what happened 30 years and more ago. But looking back, I don't believe that we did as much as we could or should have to model how matters of Jewish practice should be decided. And although I didn't see this at the time, my look backward eventually had the scales fall from my eyes as I listened to the words of Rabbi Cohen and paid attention to a remarkable transformation that came upon him in those years. It doesn't take a lot of fancy research to uncover this. It's actually right there before you if you simply look at his addresses to his colleagues in the rabbinical assembly in the late 70s and the early 80s. So it's now January 1979 in Los Angeles, California. And you want to talk, Phil, about low-tech stuff. Most of you don't know this. The curiously low-tech system we devised for getting the word out about this commission report so that people wouldn't be blindsided. There was an array of, I think, five old-time telephone answering machines with regular-sized cassettes that were all had a recording of what the report of the commission was, and people had a number to call in, and I was standing there watching these things start to turn just as the session began. I mean, it's hilariously comical from today's point of view, but that was cutting-edge technology then. When he addressed the rabbinical assembly at that convention, he spoke enthusiastically about the halachic process. He spoke about, these are his words, the supremacy of Torah and halachic norm. He spoke, these again his words, the hope that we will be able to face further halachic issues and challenges with similar chastity and authenticity. I love the word chastity here because it reflects the sense that there should ideally be some kind of immaculate quality to this process. And he asked, well, what is my perception of conservative Judaism, and how, as he put it, a committed and informed conservative Jew should approach issues such as this one? And his answer was one of his true classics, and many people in this room heard him teach this over and over again. Ki Ezra hechin levavo lidrosh et Torat Adonai. The seventh chapter of Ezra, in which Ezra, the author of Ezra, now coins a new term. It used to be Lidrosh et Adonai, to inquire of God, and now it is Lidrosh et Torat Adonai. And he said, we live by a living Torah, which we apply and develop. In the absence of prophecy, there is now a text. The answers are available to the scholar and to the exegete. The texts and their interpretations had been presented and discussed at the commission. There was the kind of cross-examination from different fields, trying to understand a little better what they were, what they meant, what they could mean. There was dialogue with the textual and exegetical experts, some of whom were on the commission and some of whom came to speak to us. And when Rabbi Cohn and the majority of the commission felt that those texts failed to forbid clearly what otherwise held out potential blessing, that became determinative. And Rabbi Cohn was convinced that this was a reaffirmation of halakha. And in speaking to that 79 convention, he said that he wanted to call for a new campaign for halakha, for our halakha, for legitimate interpretation. He said, I hope that our movement will focus on halakhic questions even more than it has, and that we will reflect this emphasis in our regular preaching. He was on a high about what an honest grappling with the classical halakhic literature could do. In a real way, he was saying what Blue Greenberg, whom you heard yesterday, what she would later make famous: where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. It was a statement of faith in the classical ways that they could be trusted to bring forth the right things. All would be well because the way in which we understood fealty to the traditional canon would bring us to the right place with no rupture necessary. All would be continuous. Now, here's one of the critical points about this particular faith that he presented then. The word God appeared exactly once in that entire speech to the RA, and it appeared in approximately the same way that Moses' name appears once in the traditional Haggadah text. In passing, formulaically, inconsequentially, as a reference to women wanting to serve God, Torah, and Israel. There it was. God was not part of the process he was celebrating. It was halakha and expertise in understanding the zitzim leben and the possible applications of the texts of halakha. All classical JTS. So how did it come about when a year later in 1980, he addressed the RA again, that all of this had changed, though I have to admit I was oblivious to it at the time, even though it was unfolding before my eyes? God appeared at least 10 times in what was for him a relatively short address to his colleagues. I'll give you a couple of examples. He begins, as he always began in Hebrew, Chaverai v'amitai ha'omdim al mishmeret Adonai. Friends and colleagues, all of whom are trustees of God. He said that no other group besides conservative Judaism is so concerned about the God of Israel. He ends with brachot from Isaiah, from the book of Isaiah, Ruchi asher alecha udvarai asher samti beficha lo yamushu mipicha, etc., etc. Chvod Adonai alayach zarach. May God's presence shine on you. But mostly what you find in that address was this. He said that we regard the totality of the Jewish experience as the embodiment of the will of God. And now I'm quoting directly from him. Not everything we do is going to be a fulfillment of the will of God, but everything must be measured by the divine will, and everything is either a response to or a retreat from it. And above all else, there was this stunning statement, some of you may have heard or read, because I previously referred to it in the Gerson Cohn Memorial Lecture I gave here about 8 years ago. He said, you and I are rabbis, speaking to the RA, and he who fails to live up to his designated role is kovesh rabanuto and kovesh nevuato. He suppresses his charge and withholds the message entrusted to him. He is thus a man who fails in his religious duty. Kovesh nevuato. Suppressing his prophetic calling, a prophetic duty. Where was the faith in Ezra's innovation of Lidrosha Torat Adonai? Of just the previous year. What had happened in between? Well, here's what had happened. At the 79 convention, in which he had triumphantly spoken of the successes and the promises of the halachic process that would now bring the other 50% of the Jewish world into the service of Torah, the RA discussions of the commission report bogged down. There was little evidence of any emerging consensus, and indeed there was a failure to endorse the report. Instead, simply a decision, really it was a non-decision, to let the faculty of JTS decide what it made of it. And the other thing that happened was that the faculty in the fall of 1979 also declined to join in their chancellor's faith in what the classical processes could legitimate. And it happened amid papers written by some faculty members invoking other halachic texts in opposition, and even assertions that a confidential teshuvah written by a senior member of the Talmud faculty, not, however, ever to be published, forbade this proposed new step to ordain women. Here was the telltale paragraph in that RA address of 1980. Quote, I would like to give up the myth that what determines the growth of our tradition is only the halachic process. And listen to these next words. I fell into this error of perception. We live in a certain climate of fear, a loss of resolve, and then we find a halachic rationale. In other words, although in January of 79 he believed with a perfect faith that where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, by the spring of 1980 he had discovered that the converse is unfortunately also true. Where there's a failure of rabbinic will, there is sure to be a halachic way to justify that failure. So if classical halachic process cannot be trusted to pave a way forward, but instead can produce stalemate and legitimate fear of change, what or whom can we trust? Well, I would say, these were not his words, but maybe they would have been, that the end of Masechet Sota tells us, Al mi yesh lanu lihishayin, al avinu shebashamayim. On whom can we depend? On our heavenly parent. No wonder God appears over and over again in that address. And no wonder he spoke of measuring everything by the divine will. And no wonder he charged the rabbis with not suppressing the essence of their rabbinate. And yes, I will say it because his lips are moving again now and saying it as he did then. The essence of the rabbinate is sometimes to be a prophetic voice in addition to an Ezra-like exegete. Do not be a Kovesh Nevuato, he warned us. It was a truly remarkable shift of perspective in that year, but it was, as everything he did was, born of serious thought and reflection on what had happened and what that gave evidence of. And I want you to know it was no passing fad. The next year, at an RA Kala in 1981, here's a sampling of what the chancellor had to say to his rabbinic colleagues. Quote, if critical learning does not have an effect on our theology, on our experience of God, we have to ask ourselves why we are engaging in it with such tenacity. Scholarship must make a difference to our experience of God as well as to our sense of ethnic continuity. Fixity of ritual, he said, without meaning, has merit only on the lowest level of religious experience. We should be tolerant of it, but to accept it as the ultimate form of religious expression is to worship a theological graven image. And he said, we can sin by not rising to the challenge of our own revelation. And here was his exegesis for that talk, because there always was some exegesis in every talk he gave. It came from the third chapter of Proverbs, Bechol drachecha da'ehu v'hu yigasher orchotecha. Only if we make it the central principle of our lives, this was his translation of it, to experience the presence and the word of God in every area of our being, will we be able to overcome the fragmentation that threatens to overwhelm us. Only then will God give meaning and direction to all that we do, and will he make our life's path, intelligible and significant. And this was, I think, what he had arrived at. A recognition that halachic process would, by its nature, be a divider. For all of our celebration of the blessings in that diversity, and I don't need to rehearse the blessings of that here in this room, but there still are times when we can be paralyzed by the, on the one hand, and on the other hand, precisely when there is a transcendent reason to move forward. So it was only a collective will to trust our experiences of God and what we have learned about the God that we worship, what we have been taught about God in the very texts that we venerate. Only that collective will can in the end unite us in a conviction to act with faith. Not everyone was comfortable with this, to put it mildly. Another revered teacher of mine, Rabbi David Weiss Halivni, Yibadel HaChaim, said, Gershon got everything right when he was a historian. He began to go wrong when he became a theologian. Private conversation. I am giving testimony today to having seen the emergence of that theologian who spoke confidently of God and a divine will. And I think he got it right. I thought of this often as I listened to colleagues at the CJLS speak about their shared and genuine feelings of anguish about the exclusionary pain experienced by Mamzerim and by gay and lesbian Jews, but being in the end unwilling to step outside the texts and answer their late chancellor's call to a different kind of faith. There would, it continued to be thought, always be a halachic way. Well, there was. For Mamzerim, it was an ingenious and beautifully and purely intended tweaking of the rules of evidence that got us off the hook. But it was not a ringing vindication of the Mamzer's moral case. And it did not get off the hook a conscientious seeker branded as a Mamzer because of a personal history he didn't control, who was not interested in what the rules of evidence were, but rather wanted to know what God wants of him. And for gay men in particular, there was also a halachic way, and again, ingenious and beautifully and purely intended interpretation of the text to bring them in as far as possible, even to the rabbinate, but with a rather non-trivial prescribed restriction on their intimate lives. It was not, in other words, a ringing vindication of the moral case that they have, even over the canonized texts. So I'm left to wonder how the matter of the Mamzer and the matter of Jews of different sexualities might have been better handled if we, and I include myself, had understood much earlier what our teacher himself had learned about what is a good model for change in Jewish practice. And since other matters of great human significance will continue to come our way, I think it remains a challenge for us if we are truly to display to the world at large and the Jewish world in particular what it means to be a people of God. I owe the recognition of that challenge to my teacher, but I will always regret that I understood it a little too late to be able to tell him so.
Obviously, I'm speaking to you today because of my recent tshuva on women and mitzvot. And the real question about this tshuva is, why did it appear in 2014 when it would have made more sense for it to have appeared in 1984 or at least 1994. How often are our tshuvot audacious? How often do our tshuvot push the envelope, challenging us and inspiring us to reinvigorate our spirituality, to be more devoted in our search for God? And I think Gordon has given us an answer to this question, and I will return to it at the end. So I want to take a step back, right, about the issue of women's ordination and egalitarianism, because this is the point in the history of our movement and the Jewish community as a whole to reflect on where we are. So my tshuva was both retrospective and prospective. Where have we come from? Where are we now? And to where are we aspiring? It's breathtaking to see where we've come from. Who would have thought in 1954, when the RA passed its first resolution calling on the CJLS to equalize the status of women, or even in the 1970s, right, that our movement would become overwhelmingly egalitarian? What strikes us today as commonplace or even trite, what we don't even bash an eyelash at, would have been amazing to think of 40 years ago, or even 30 years ago, right? Or even 50 years ago, right? Women regularly having aliyot, counting in the minyan, bat mitzvah is a matter of course, right? We just sort of yawn at that, right? But if we were to go back 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it would have been amazing. Who would have thought that egalitarianism would sweep the movement? Many people thought that women's participation would remain marginal in the movement, limited to isolated congregations, with women in the rabbinate being few and far between. They never imagined that the overwhelming number of conservative congregations, schools, and institutions would become egalitarian. But that's exactly what has happened. Who could have foreseen it? And I want to emphasize, egalitarianism is, of course, about the participation of women, but it's not just. It's about inspiring all Jews, both men and women, to observe mitzvot. It's about everyone participating in Jewish observance, in studying Torah and being valued in Jewish communal life. And it's a sign of the maturation of Jews in America and elsewhere toward heightened observance and communities of Jews thirsting for Torah. Egalitarianism has helped clarify the nature of conservative Judaism. It is halachic and it is egalitarian. It has identified what is to be preserved and what is open for innovation. When the leaders of conservative Judaism used the slogan tradition and change, it left the movement open to criticism because the intellectual and spiritual leaders seemed either to focus on change, not tradition, or to be vague and lacking a clear, coherent message. Right? And for a long time, and we still have it, numbers seem to be our obsession and our focus. But we really need to shift course, and I hope that egalitarianism has helped us put our energy into nurturing observance, inspiring Torah study, and reflecting on Jewish ideals. So egalitarianism reflects how our view of Judaism is distinct. We are both traditional and innovative. Women observing more mitzvot is at once both deeply traditional and profoundly innovative. And while it might seem that extending women's observance to include mitzvot from which they've traditionally been exempted and often excluded may seem radical to some, it demonstrates our profound love for tradition. We want more Jews to search for God and live in holiness through the observance of mitzvot. Now, where are we? One of the greatest dangers, and not just to the movement, but to Torah, is that we may have become egalitarian style rather than egalitarian. That egalitarianism will be put into place only in the most shallow of ways rather than put into effect fully. Right? On a number of levels. One, that a wide array of rituals will be open to women without nurturing lives filled with the daily routines of Torah and the search for God. Egalitarianism then will just be a veneer. Right? Teaching women, for example, to serve as leaders of tefillot without nurturing a daily prayer life is hollow. And second, we need to think through what it means to be egalitarian and how that has an impact on marriage and divorce and so many other areas that we hesitate to tread into. Some of you may know that I am a member of the Joint Beit Din, which deals with matters of preventing agunot. And I assure you we've had a lot of discussions, or tried to have discussions, and more about that perhaps privately. Okay. So let me now focus on my tshuva. And even though I wrote the tshuva, I want to acknowledge the role that other rabbis have played in this tshuva and applaud what they have done. I think Susan Grossman is here somewhere. Okay. So I want to thank her. For inviting me, or drafting me, or volunteering me to write on this topic, and of course for the work she has done in the realm of halacha. I'd also like to thank Judith Hauptman, who was here. He's teaching, I believe. And Gail Leibovitz. And many others, who some of whom made the footnotes and some of whom didn't. Okay? Now, this may be the rare tshuva of a law committee that mentions God and spirituality. And in fact, the first section of the tshuva is on theology and spirituality with a little bit of history thrown in. Okay? My tshuva could have started with the Mishnah and halachic texts. And in fact, an earlier draft did begin that way. But I felt that in order to shape the landscape, I needed to have a beginning that was theological, homiletical, and reflective. And so I began with these reflections about how mitzvot are essential to our spirituality, to our search for God, and for the way we enrich and sanctify our lives in daily routines of Torah. How we shape our search for God through mitzvot. Women have always been responsible to observe certain mitzvot, but they were exempted from certain mitzvot that men were required to observe. And in many, and perhaps most cases, when women were exempted from a specific mitzvah, that exemption was extended erroneously to mean that women were forbidden from observing it. Right? Most significantly, women were exempted from the study of Torah, and therefore played a greatly limited role in learning and interpreting Torah. And I want to try an experiment for us to understand what these exemptions mean. Right? Perhaps in Gordon's honor, I shall call it a thought experiment. Right? So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. And to think how your spirituality is shaped when you recite the Shema in the morning and in the evening. how saying words like Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, right, how that shapes your day. And how, if you were told, you don't need to do that, right, you don't need to say that, how that injects coldness and alienation and distance from God. Because Jewish women were exempted from reciting the Shema. Right? Right? And by contrast, right, they were required to pray, and we can debate whether it was a Shemona Esrei or some Bakasha, and whether it's two times a day or three times a day. But asking for something, that petitionary prayer, is a response to wants and needs. And every creature, animal, human, has those needs. But what makes us Jews and shapes our lives as Jews is the Shema. Now, it is true that from time to time, some women sought to observe mitzvot from which they had been exempted. But I must emphasize how sporadic and limited this number of women was. In the past century, especially in recent decades, women have sought to suffuse their lives with greater Torah and more mitzvot. And at the same time, cultural attitudes have shifted dramatically in society in general. And doors into business and the professions formerly closed to women are now open. Women participate in public life in ways unimaginable a century ago or even a few decades ago. This is not just a change in external behavior, but an intellectual and psychological transformation in how women perceive themselves and are perceived by others. Women are now seen as equal to men in social status and political and legal rights, in intellectual ability by both men and women. And this is a new worldview that has resulted in new roles for women. And so what egalitarianism has shown is that for many Jewish women, the pathway of observance that Judaism had traditionally assigned to women was no longer and is no longer sufficient. They want to observe more mitzvot and participate equally. They want to study Torah in the same depth and breadth that Jewish men have enjoyed. And this development has happened in most, if not all, Jewish communities. And we have been at the forefront of this development. Right? From the very beginning, the conservative movement, more or less, started educating women, often on an equal or near equal basis with men. And in conservative communities, opening mitzvot to women has led to the implicit assumption, right, that women are equally obligated to observe the mitzvot as men. But right, we have not stated it explicitly and articulated clearly, really, until about a year ago. Right? We've said it here and there. And it's taken that much time for the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, right, to articulate that clearly. I want to move on for a moment to the halachic materials. There's much more in my tshuva, and it's a 34-page single space glory. I am determined that my next tshuva will be shorter. We'll see whether it survives the next committee of the next meeting of the law committee in its shortness. Okay. So I think we're familiar more or less with this category, right, of time-bound positive mitzvot, right, which is presented in the Mishnah right, as the principal. Right? And in fact, when I was researching my tshuva, I was quite amazed to find out how few mitzvot were in that category. That is, time-bound positive mitzvot, right? Only number 6, and possibly a 7th. So, women were exempted from reciting the Shema, taking up the lulav, hearing the shofar, residing in a sukkah, wearing tzitzit, and putting on tefillin, and some include counting the omer. Right? So it's really a principle that kind of needs to be more. Right? Furthermore, rabbinic tradition exempts women from the obligation to perform specific positive mitzvot that are not time-bound. Rabbinic tradition also excluded women from communal ceremonies, even though, of course, they could watch or view such a ceremony. Right? And so, these characteristics show that this principle, right, this category of positive and time-bound is problematic. And even more, many mitzvot from which women were exempted do not have to be performed in a narrow window of time. And for something like lulav, how much time does that actually take? Okay? We've also seen, right, there are all these exceptions, right, and they suggest that this category is not prescriptive at all. And importantly, right, women were put in the same category as minors and slaves with an essential difference. Minors can grow up. Slaves can be emancipated. But women always remain with limited capacity. Okay, we'll deal. There is yet another transsexual, but we won't deal with that today. Okay. So even the Babylonian Talmud acknowledges that this category does not hold up well. Okay. And so where did it come from? I'm persuaded that it originated for exegetical reasons, and only afterwards was it transformed or perceived to be a prescriptive category. But whether or not you agree with me about how it originated historically, we all know that it is a problematic category because of the many exceptions. Right? So why were women exempted from certain mitzvot? Because they, along with slaves and minors, right, were subordinate to others, right, and were not of the social standing required to perform certain mitzvot. Right? And what's important to note is that the rabbis did assume that women had the intellectual and psychological ability to fulfill a number of domestic mitzvot on behalf of their household, mitzvot whose breach incurred serious consequences for the household, including the male head of the household. Right? And I want to emphasize this point. Right? They required women to do this, right, without any concern for any idea about the lack of knowledge or reliability or intellect on the part of women. They assumed that they had the intellectual and psychological capacities. Right? But women were excluded from certain ritual acts because those ritual acts should only be fulfilled by those of highest social standing, those who were independent and not subordinate to anyone else. And in their view, only males were thought to be fitting candidates to serve and honor God in the most fit way. A historian of medieval Jewish history, Avraham Grossman, points out a significant consequence of women's exemption in his study of Jewish women in the Middle Ages. He argues that it had a great impact on how women were perceived by their communities, in the communities in which they lived. Right? So a Jewish community, he felt, perceives itself to be a holy congregation, and those who participated in religious life were esteemed. Moreover, the synagogue was the most important institution, not just because of its position in the religious life of a community, but also because it served as a meeting place for the members of the community to discuss matters of communal concern. And Grossman notes that women's exemption led to the perception that they were inferior, including questioning whether they even could take part in an afterlife. Right? And there's more in the 34 pages of my tshuva on that. Okay? Now, the history of women's participation in the conservative movement. Right? I'm going to focus on the law committee, but I want to emphasize that's far from the complete story of halakhic change, right, in the movement. Right? And I must emphasize that point. Okay? It was astonishing to me to discover that 1954 resolution of the law committee of the Rabbinical Assembly, which states, I quote, "We call upon our Committee on Jewish Law and Standards and upon the Joint Conference to intensify their effort to formulate additional takanot leading to the complete equalization of the status of women in Jewish law as a true expression of a Torah of justice." Unquote. 1954. Wow. Right? Right? In 1955, right, the first two votes on whether women could have an aliyah. Okay, one saying anytime, and the other saying only on special occasions. Okay? Right? Jump forward to 1973. I can only imagine what actually happened that's not recorded in the minutes. Right? If I could. Right? Especially that resolution. Man, that must have been fantastic. Okay? Right? Right? In 1973, right, there was a takana issued that allowed women to be counted in a minyan. Right? Although it was noted in the mailing to the members of the RA that, like the other decisions of the law committee, each rabbi and congregation would make the decision whether or not to follow the new CJLS ruling. Okay? The position papers of the faculty of JTS, I think you've read them, and I don't need to go into them. And in recent decades, we've issued more tshuvot, right? So the issue about Aliyot traditionally reserved for male descendants of Kohanim and Levim, can women have them? Addressed in 89. In 1993, whether a ceremony equivalent to Pidyon HaBen should be performed for the firstborn daughter. I don't know if Gerald Skolnick is here. Hey, all right, thank you. His tshuva. Okay? A tshuva on whether women who are bat kohen could participate in the ritual of the priestly blessing. The tshuvot of Susan Grossman and Rabbi Mike Geller, Rabbi Susan Grossman and Rabbi Mike Geller, on women and a dut approved in 2001. Rabbi David Fine, okay, on women in the minyan in 2002. Right? And there are, I think, other tshuvot on women's topics that are coming through. Right? So I want to reflect on halachic change in general and go back to what I mentioned at the beginning and to riff, as it were, on what Gordon said. Halacha is not a system of rules and statutes. Right? A set of statutes to be mechanically manipulated. We must reach into and beyond the rules in supplementing an old rule or creating a fresh rule. Right? And that sentence that I just said, right, that's actually a quote from Justice Cardozo, who wrote this wonderful and tremendously insightful book, The Nature of the Judicial Process. It's not about manipulating rules. It's about reaching in and beyond the rules. When we do halakha, we transform Jewish tradition into new patterns of meaning. When we do halakha, we're in an act of conversation. We shape and reshape our community through a shared language of values, assumptions, and aspirations. We create a new pattern of meaning. We create a new narrative that reimagines our community. And so this new pattern of meaning that we have done, right, in egalitarianism, in the ordination of women, is about equality in the search for God, in infusing our lives with holiness through mitzvot. Women's ordination and egalitarianism go hand in hand. Right? Some argued, right, that women had to be observant for a couple generations, right, in order to prove that they were worthy of being rabbis. But what they didn't understand is that what we needed were women rabbis to serve as role models and teachers. And we needed male rabbis who played a great role in this, encouraging and inspiring women and girls in taking on more mitzvot, in studying Torah, in taking their spiritual journeys more seriously. Women's ordination and egalitarianism are two sides of the same coin. They go together. And I think we have all the same answer to the question, do we want only female rabbis to observe mitzvot? Right? Right? And the tshuva that was issued by the law committee challenges us to inspire women and all Jews to not be in a rut, to not be overwhelmed by the day-to-day running of our congregation, our schools, our institutions, but to remember that our true aim is to guide our people into more Torah, into more holiness. Right? This tshuva is meant to challenge us, to inspire us, and we pray that our people will enrich their lives with mitzvot and with seeking God, both in public and in private. Thank you.
Do we have questions for our two wonderful speakers and teachers? Bakasha.
I was thinking maybe we should take a few questions and
then still remember.
Oh, I'll remember that one, yeah.
I'm Ravi Tillis in Merrick, New York. And so I so appreciate both presentations. And I obviously, it spoke to me personally. But I come upon challengers, and I need a little bit of help with language to combat our challengers. And while we may or may not be obsessed with numbers, there are other people who are obsessed with numbers, and they'll say to me and to other of my colleagues, well, look at where the numbers are strongest, or where women are not included. That's what they'll say to me. They'll say, women where you make space for women observance, then the numbers go down. And obviously, I don't believe in that, all right? I'm not even a messenger. I need help in combating that argument, because to those where numbers are the only thing that do matter, I do have a hard time combating that.
This is for, I guess, all of the group and panel. I'm struck that at this late date, 30 years after the ordination of women, that a majority of women in my congregation, and I assume most, do not wear tallis and tefillin. Girls get a matching tallis for their bat mitzvah, which promptly arrives in the drawer, never to be seen again. And I have struggled mightily with how to change that culture. Even my own daughters have failed. So, what can we do about that?
This is addressed more to Rabbi Tucker, but to both of the speakers. You're challenging us to use the halakhic process as a way of making substantive change and really taking a bit between our teeth. And I think that we define ourselves as a halakhic movement, but at least in my community, and I think in many communities like it, halakha is something that gets spoken of when I'm teaching to my community in the context of text or when I'm speaking to rabbinic colleagues, and it's not part of the dialogue with my congregation as part of our daily interactions. And I think that one of the dimensions of the decision to admit women to the rabbinate and subsequently to admit gays and lesbians to the rabbinate is that those were halakha discussions that actually took on such force that they spilled over and were known to the rank and file of our membership. And I'm wondering what it would mean if the discussions that went on in our movement, if the process of halakha was an open process that we, in fact, I as a rabbi don't know what discussions are taking place now within the Committee for Law and State. What if this was a discussion that was widely known, and if the questions we were debating were questions that we actually felt were something that our lay people would have a vibrant interest in being part of?
Ed?
This is a different order question. It's a historical question. And I thought about this for 35 years, so I wonder. Why did the faculty get to vote? If this was...
You already punted.
Wait a minute. If this was halakha, it should have been voted by the people who make halakha. This was a religious issue for the leadership of a religious community. The faculty of the seminary was never hired to be the leaders of that religious community. They were hired because they wrote sterling PhDs. Why was there neither a plebiscite, nor a poll of congregations, nor a rabbinical assembly vote? Who the heck empowered the faculty to make this decision?
Okay. So the first thing that I want to emphasize is that I think this was meant to be implicit in what I said. I hope it was that it was a bit of a lament that, and in a way, you heard a lament from Pamela as well. But why did it take this long? I think that if we had been speaking the language of an experience of God personally and communally earlier on in terms of what motivates Jewish practice, we'd be farther along in this understanding of what it means to have some kind of neo, because the old prophet stuff, loincloths and walking around barefoot for 2 years, I mean, that clearly had to die. I mean, that's not good. Obviously that had to die. That was the whole thing. I mean, that's what he taught us about Ezra. I mean, that. But, as I've often said, many of you have heard me say it, I worry more and more about how much of the baby was thrown out with the bathwater. Is there no prophetic moment left in religious life? Now, you're right that we don't, first of all, I, your your question reflects a bias, that everything to be stable and to be safe and secure has to be systematized. I'm not sure I agree with that anymore at this late stage of life. If we had been thinking about what a prophetic moment is, that you can say to a rabbi, don't be a kovation vuacha, which was an astounding thing to hear from him. I mean, my jaw dropped when I heard that. I didn't get all the implications of it. It's like, what? If we had been thinking about this and talking about it, if the ways in which things like this were brought up and were dismissed as, mere homiletics, mere haggadah. By the way, 2 years later, in 1983, when he spoke to the RA, he was memorializing Heschel. It was just after the 10th Yahrzeit for Heschel. And he said, I find myself bemoaning and lamenting the years in which I belittled the homiletic nature of what Jewish teaching is about. And recalled how when Heschel first came here in 1945, he and his chevra, who gathered around to hear him, found him unintelligible, and that Heschel found them unintelligible. They found him unintelligible because they weren't prepared to hear all this God talk, and he found them unintelligible because he didn't understand how people in their 20s could already be such confirmed skeptics. And he was lamenting all of this. Because there is some transcendence that's an irreducible part of religion, and that will always defy systematization. So I don't disagree with you that we have a lot of work to do in a sense of how to make that more safe and secure. But the alternative is not to have any of that prophetic moment at all in our religion, not to be able to say as Aaron, the priest of all people, said to his brother, the prophet, is this really what God wants? We didn't read it that long ago. Next time it comes up, pay closer attention to it. It's a remarkable role reversal, not so different from the role reversal I saw in one person those years ago. So I think that is an important piece of work ahead of us. The importance of numbers. It's always been kind of curious to me that when we had a lot of numbers weren't important, When we were the majority of the people didn't look at us and say, hey, they've got the numbers, they must be doing something right. When the numbers start dwindling, suddenly numbers become the most important measure. My advice to you is I wouldn't get too concerned about that. I think for all of us, we concentrate on the work that we have to do and stop thinking about numbers. Yes, there are some people who care about numbers. There are a few of them.
That's a very definite rule. Okay. I may be old, but I haven't lost the sense of humor.
One of the challenges is, of course, the egalitarian side. Right? They get the talit for their bat mitzvah, and if by chance they come back the following Shabbat, where did it go? It's funny. I was a congregational rabbi for many years. Most people think of me as just a scholar, and I was amazed in this older congregation how many of the women being pushed, right, started to take it on. And yet I still hear from college students, right, that they heard a talit is a male garment. Where are they getting this from? Right? I mean, considering, I've now been in the rabbinate longer than they've been alive, it seems quite astonishing. Okay? So I think that when it comes to deal with, I don't know whether to call it resistance or reluctance, we need to do two things. We need to both be bold and to use peer pressure. That is to be bold in talking and teaching people about their relationship with God and how to be willing to be an outlier, right? How to stand up
and seek out. And that having that relationship with God doesn't mean just going with the flow, but often enough means going against that flow. In resisting, in charting one's own path, especially in such a materialistic world. I mean, I can see it, you know, now I've been a professor for I don't know how many years. You know, when I first started out, students actually talked to each other, right, in the quad. Right? Now I see them talking but not interacting with the person nearby. They're talking on their phones to somebody, I don't know, on the other side of campus, the other side of the planet. Right? And it's also reduced what goes on in the classroom. Right? And so we need, in emphasizing what it is to have a relationship with God, is also about having a relationship with people, that sometimes it means to have that one-on-one. It means sometimes to be one against one. Right? So to teach our people to be bold, to go against the grain, right? To be willing to stand up and speak out. At the same time, we also need to utilize a peer group. Right? We all know that as much as our relationship with God in private as an individual is so important, it also has to be part of a community. And so we need to create in our congregations, our schools, our camps and institutions, right, where the young women, our older women, our middle-aged women who are not yet willing to stand up, stand out, wear a talit, put on tefillin, they can learn together. In a lot of ways, lay people teaching lay people, right, is more effective. So we need to be both bold, right, as well as using, utilizing peer pressure and conformity. As for numbers, let me just add this one. Think of what the conservative movement would be without egalitarianism. Those numbers would really, what diplomatic word should I use?
Reckless.
Okay. That would really be frightening. And so we need to turn the discussion around and to say, right, look at what's happening elsewhere and where we are and how we've grown, right, in a time when materialism, in a time when economic stress, in a time when so many other things grab our attention. And I often like to give the example, I'm a classical music fan. Right? If you want to know where it's really bad, check out your local symphony, or your opera. That's bad news. Right? And if you want to see poor employment, just go across the street, right? Right? And see what their employment records are. That's sad.
Two things. I want to get to Ed's question. I don't know if I have an answer that'll satisfy you. I mean, is that the RA thought that they did. The CJLS, you know, was not, in my recollection, looked to with the same same kind of way that it has been for in recent years. A lot of the procedures have been improved enormously in terms of the writing of Shuvot, the publishing of Shuvot, and the CJLS actually in 1974, I think it was, there was one of these, you know, Bo Bayom, you know, Yinu V'Gamru, June 10th, I think it was, they made a million decisions, and one of them was by the three-vote rule was already had endorsed the ordination of women. So I think there was always a bit of an ambiguity as to whether this was a religious decision that was being made in terms of admitting women to the rabbinical school, or whether it was an admissions decision that was going to be made against the backdrop of some of the religious implications that now have been dealt with by the commission. I think that was the idea. May or may not have been the ideal way to do it. The one other thing I want to say about the developing this language of halakha in youth, this isn't a comprehensive answer, but I'm just sharing a few thoughts with you, one thought in particular. At the time when this whole idea of youth was being discussed in 1984, the general tenor of the conversation was that Chiyuv was about, and the people who were unwilling to lotimate chiyuvim on women was that a chiyuv means that there are consequences for not doing it. That the measure of chiyuv is how you feel, how others look at you, what your theological status is when you're not doing the thing that you're mechuyevet to do. And I think that is completely out of whack and will not be comprehended by certainly our constituency, and I think by most modern American constituencies. Chiyuv to me is exactly the opposite. It's the way, the measure of it is how you feel when you're doing it. Do you feel as if you are doing something compelling, something that is obligatory because it is a contribution not just to your spiritual state at the moment, but to the community at large? Or is it something that, feels good right now, but maybe it won't tomorrow? I think, by the way, that to me, that's always what Rabbi Chanina's dictum has been about. Gadol HaMitzuveh Lo Aseh, because if a person comes to Minyan because they feel spiritual this morning, I don't know that I can count on them tomorrow for the Minyan. That's why Mechuyevet. If a person has that feeling of obligation, that I think we can teach people. That is directly connected, I think, to speaking the God language and getting them into the touch with their own feelings, which I believe every human being has, of experiencing God.
I want to talk more about making our discussions of halacha and pressing issues part of our community, right? So that, I don't remember who asked the question. Right? I mean, how come we don't know what's going on? Some of you who are members of law committee and perhaps members of the executive council know that I'm chairing a working group of the law committee, which is trying to revamp what we do. And we've started to make changes that we see internally to law committee, but it will take a few years before the results, right, are seen to the members of the RA and the conservative movement. Right? If I can use a slogan, we're trying to write better materials on more central topics in a more timely way. Right, to try and figure out what are the pressing issues that we need to write on. Because sometimes tshuvot are written on a topic that's kind of like a bee in a rabbi's bonnet. Right? Not necessarily what's really pressing, what's really central. And so we're trying to identify those topics. And sometimes we're doing a better job, and sometimes we need to think more about how to do that. We also need to think about the types of materials, right? Educational materials, how to do outreach, right? And we're trying. We try to change the way that we discuss things, right? Because sometimes rabbis are reading the drafts on the plane or the train, right? And we need more sort of sustained thought, right? We're thinking things through. So we're trying to change, right? And hopefully you'll start to see the positive results of that soon enough. But it is important for us to try to focus on, right, central topics, right, things of pressing concern, controversial topics, and how to spread the discussion out, how to teach what we've spent so much time working on and thinking about, and, you know, asking our friends and colleagues in the RA to read drafts. I'm sure there's some people here who don't want to get an email from me, right, saying, please read this long thing. Right? So that's important, and we're working on it, but we need to do it even more.
Two more questions?
Yeah. I don't want to be the one to make this choice here.
Let's do
you take the heat.
Okay. Let's do one male and one female question.
Please.
I read
them. And what is a comment about Yugua and Neo Yugua?
And Neo.
Neo Yugua.
Bad term, but okay.
Whatever. There's a whole literature. Ralph Cook talked about the accessibility of Yugua for every person through the cultivation, nurturing, and development of the religion of the Dimayon. And so
he went further. He said that the absence of that is the absence of that is almost the definition of galut.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the alienation of the I, right. Of the anokhi. That's right. It's the anokhi in galut. So it seems to me, if you know me and you know my cries of the heart here, yeah, because of the absence of that, that perhaps we should embrace part of those writings, and not because it's a certain spiritual, political, in Israel, which it wasn't, and that's his son, Tzvi Yehuda, and it has volumes, he has volumes and volumes and volumes to teach us about how every person, through a conscious cultivation, can reach Nibbuah in our day. So I will put that out there, that should be part of the agenda. And I would love to hear from you.
So,
he's a kid.
And this really hurts my heart that I taught in two different conservative venues, and I was told that I was too spiritual. I have a letter in writing from the director of education that, and I'm not saying this as a as a statement of gaiva, please, it's a statement of pain. You know, that I was one of the most spiritual people that, and I didn't go into crunchy granola and doing my yoga buzz at all. So I don't know. Teaching in our teaching kids was not the place for me. That's what he said. In two different venues, he said, maybe if you had a class of motivated kids that just really got you and just wanted to take you with them where you were, that would be possible. But then he said, frankly, I don't know such a place. And that was a shattering statement on so many levels. So how do we cultivate neshamas in an age-appropriate way? When I was told this by two different directors, I really asked that question.
So, first of all, thank you to both of you for beautiful teaching. I want to offer and check with you about a distinction I see between the move for egalitarianism, which focused on the question of the ordination of women, and the move toward the tshuva on the normalization of the status of gays and lesbians. The former, as you pointed out, Pamela, is about the chumra, extending the chiyuv to all people. The latter is not about a chumra. The latter is about that impulse for nivuah, that impulse, lidrosh et Adonai, lidrosh et Torah Adonai. It's important because as you said in your remarks, Pamela, we are concerned, all of us here, and from the question I came over here, I don't know my colleague's name, that people perceive, with regards to the gay and lesbian issue, that was about rabbis. It wasn't about rabbis, and many of us continue to make that error when we speak about it. As a gay rabbi, I don't give a damn about gay and lesbian rabbis. I care about gay and lesbian Jews, some of whom choose to adopt a life of mitzvot and become rabbis. And our challenge as rabbis is to speak the language of the Drosha Adonai and the Drosha Torah Adonai and promote innovation in halakha. When we can do that successfully, and when we can speak the language of Qumran and inspire commitment around mitzvot on its own terms, that's what we need to do. But there's a distinction between the two movements. They share, they have a commonality, but they also have a distinction in how they developed and historically and what they mean traditionally. So thank you for your question.
Our two wonderful teachers each have 2 minutes left before we have to conclude to answer and to make any final comments or wish.
Joel, I'm not sure what to say, what to add to what you just said. I don't think I disagree with anything that you said, or have very much to add to it. I think that talking about Chumrah and Kula sometimes is a very slippery thing. People will look at the same thing in different ways. But I agree with you. There are commonalities. There are some common denominators. Human dignity aspect of it, Tovah Nenalakol, Verachamah Kol Maasav, etc., rings through both of them. But they are, to some extent, about different things. About the language of spirituality, I think you're right. We are missing it. But first of all, this is not meant specifically to you or to anyone else. But let's remember that it's not a new thing in the Jewish world. That sometimes, rabbis and communities, are kind of on the same wavelength, and sometimes, a Hasidic rabbi moves from one part of Eastern Europe to another part because they're more receptive to the message that he has to give. So, we all live with that to some extent. But what you say is more globally true. We are somewhat impoverished, or maybe more than somewhat impoverished in that, and it does give people the spooks a little bit when we talk about God and spirituality, but that's exactly the agenda. There are many ways to approach it. I've been involved, and other people here have been, with the Institute for Jewish Spirituality for the last almost 10 years, and made a tremendous impact on my life, and through me, I think, on members of my congregation, but they're not the only people who are concerned about this. The good news is that there are people, thoughtful people, who are very deeply concerned about the fact that people it's not just that there were too many Jews who are untrained and unused to this kind of talk, which is, after all, what is this supposed to be about anyway? But the worst problem is that there are people who really are interested in it, and they're not finding it with us. So they go elsewhere. So it is rather urgent, and I think you're right. You're absolutely right to bring it up.
Well, I have to say I'm not quite in agreement that the women's issue is not nevuah, right? That it's just about chiyuv, and in fact that's why I felt...
Oh, I didn't hear that. But if he said that, then I agree with you.
Okay. Because I think it is about nivuah. It is about resetting and reshaping the landscape according to a principle of equality, right? Of access, of shaping, of making women's spiritual journeys important and taking them seriously. Right. So I do think it's not a matter of chiyuv. I mean, I do like what Gordon said, that chiyuv is about what happens when you do it, not when you don't do it. Because, as we know, if you wait until you feel spiritually inclined, right, until you wait to pray until you're in a cathedral nature, how often are you going to pray? Right? And indeed, part of prayer, right, and part of having a spiritual life, and part of doing the right thing
is to do it even though your inclination goes the other way, right? To pray when things are tough, not just to praise God when things are going well, right? To find those resources when things are difficult and challenging and overwhelming and bleak, right? And so that's, right, what a spiritual life is, right? So I do think that women and mitzvot, right, is really a nivuah, right? It's taking those higher principles of going beyond and above the rules to reshape our landscape, to reshape the way we perceive and conceive. And as for spiritual language, we really do need to work on it. And maybe, part of the issue is trying to look at larger issues, to not get bogged down in text, or when we do look in text, right, to go beyond that, to think about that. And I think that really calls upon us, right, as rabbis and teachers and scholars and thinkers and as Jews, right, to think through this, right, and to make that our goal, right, in the midst of everything else that we have to take care of in our personal lives and our professional lives.
All right.